Today I want to weave together three themes that are built around the movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, and its lead actor. First of these themes is what we are to make of unwanted gifts, or even as in the story of Adam and Eve, gifts that bring curses. Second, once our eyes have been opened with a new gift, how do we proceed while holding on to what is good in our life? What was good before the gift? And finally, is there something in these stories that can guide us forward in this congregation as we live into a pledge to work with the Aboriginal peoples to advance the struggles for justice in this land? And I hope you'll get that connection. Just as in our chalice lighting words this morning, within these stories, there is dark and there is light, and it is good. The story The Gods Must Be Crazy was produced in South Africa by James Ace and released in 1980. It became a worldwide phenomenon and was followed by a series of sequels, each one worse than the preceding one. So the brief clip from the movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, sets the scene for the central plot. It shows, I showed that clip to introduce the movie and to give you a sense of the person, the actor that I'll refer to as Gao. His picture is on the front of the Order of Service. His name is unpronounceable for most of us. In his native language, there are clicks and other sounds that are beyond my capability to reproduce. The movie is largely set in the Kalahari Desert in southwest Africa, in Botswana, near the border with Namibia. In the clip, you see an unexpected gift, grace, if you will, from the gods, an empty Coca-Cola bottle. Before the bottle was given by the gods, the clan of this sand bushman were living an idyllic life, according to the story. No one asked for the gift, and while at first it seemed like a wonderful gift, it soon became a source of jealousy and division among the people, became known as an evil thing. And Gao sets out to rid his clan of this evil thing by throwing it off the ends of the earth. Along the way, he gets entangled with a series of misunderstandings, daring adventures involving people from the civilized world, and people with a way of life that he had no previous experience with and no idea existed. At the end of the movie, Gao completes his odyssey by coming to the edge of a huge cliff. And the only thing that he can see below him are clouds. And as far in the distance as he can see are clouds. And he has found the end of the earth. And he throws the bottle off the cliff into the clouds, and he returns to his idyllic life in the clan. Idyllic with their harmony among themselves, their harmony with nature, and their harmony with God restored. So that's a very kind of incomplete summary of the movie. There is much slapstick comedy. It's actually a very entertaining movie. And there's a lot of interesting observations about modern Western culture and our idealization of the natural life of the hunter-gatherer bushman. I actually want to arrange a showing of the movie in the church. Maybe we'll do it on the traditional, the first Friday film nights. But I got to figure out what the copyright regulations are. The lead actor in the film, Gao, was discovered by the producer, James Ace. And at that time, he had very limited exposure to Western culture. He was skilled in the ways of his people. He was a skilled hunter. He was a charismatic leader. He spoke three different African languages, as well as some Afrikaans. It's a very funny piece of entertainment with a very idealized Eurocentric message about the life of the hunter-gatherer before the arrival of civilization. But what took it beyond being an entertaining little movie was, and took it to become really quite a profound experience, was a trailer at the end of the movie. It's a separate feature that happened to be on the version that I rented. I had no idea it was there. A bit of serendipity again. The little film is 28 minutes long, and it appears on the 2004 release of this movie. Again, the movie was originally released in 1980. The producer of that little film, called The Journey to Nainai, was Daniel Reisenfeld. And he decided in 1990, 10 years after release of the film, that he wanted to go back and find Gal and see what was going on in his life. Because Gal was really a charismatic figure in this film. He's really something to watch. I don't know whether everyone would feel the same way, but as an aging man, watching him then and then later in his life, I found it very moving and very something I could identify with. So he went back in 1990, and then he went back again in 2003, and each time he found Gal and did some filming. When Rosenfeld found Gal in 1990, Gal was back living with his clan in a tiny village in the Kalahari Desert. It is nothing like the idyllic village of the movie. It was dirty, it was brown, and it was cold. Despite the fact that the movie had made over $100 million, Gal was living in destitution. His people were literally dying of starvation around him. On the second visit in 2003, Gal was living better. But he was still following the traditional ways of his people. As part of Rosenfeld's project, solar cells were installed on a nearby school in a remote village where Gal lived. And they used that solar power to power a laptop computer. And the children are fascinated by this computer. It's the first time they've seen anything like it. First time they've ever even seen a movie. They were able to watch it on the computer. And Gal speaks to the school children, telling them about how life is much better now than it was when he made that movie, when he was a child. So Rosenfeld remarks in a voiceover in the film, "I can't help feeling like that computer just fell out of the sky, just like the Coca-Cola bottle in the film. And would it be an agent for good or an agent for evil?" I found actually the newspaper clipping from the Namibia News, which I don't normally read, published July the 11th, 2003. It was on the death, published the week after the death of Gal. I want to quote from that article. "In death as in life, Gal, Namibia's most famous actor, will be a bridge between the thousand-year-old hunter-gatherer culture of the Bushmen and Western civilization. He will be buried on Saturday in a semi-traditional ceremony in Sumkwe, along with his second wife. The actor of the world-famous The Gods Must Be Crazy movies died while hunting in the desert last week, Tuesday. Official records say he was 59 years old, but he did not know his exact age. By the time he died, Gal had all but given up the modern way of life, having sold his brick house in Sumkwe to live with his family in the traditional huts in their village outside the capital of the former Bushman land. Gal converted to Christianity and was baptized a Seventh-day Adventist in the year 2000. In the 1990s, with the help of the film company, Gal built his first brick house, a solid three-bedroom house, fully furnished. The actor's relatives descended on the house, as many as 30 at once, to share in the wealth. And over the years, they began to sell the chairs and the fridges and the beds and the cupboards. And after his wife passed away, relatives were selling the furniture for alcohol. Gal sold the house at the beginning of this year, the year that he died, because he felt his relatives were abusing it. A local businessman paid him 20 herd of cattle, 5 calves, and a mixture of banknotes and groceries. And Gal then moved to another small village, 27 kilometers east of Tsumkwe. At his death, his wealth consisted of 21 cattle, 11 sheep, 2 horses, 2 bicycles, 2 spades, 2 rakes, and 5 axes, including 3 traditional ones that he had made himself. On Monday last week, this is still quoting from the article, he woke up at 6 a.m. as usual, collected firewood, and made tea that he sipped with his father-in-law. He then took his bird traps, his bow and arrow, and his hunting pouch and set off to hunt, his main target being guinea fowl. He did not come back that day. Gal's father-in-law tracked him the next morning and found him on a path back home, bow and arrow strapped to his shoulder. His death certificate lists cause of death as multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. The gift that Gal received was not a Coca-Cola bottle, but the gift of a role in a successful movie in a culture that he was not prepared for. It was at best a mixed blessing, and certainly once the gift was given, there was no turning back. There was no way to throw this gift off the end of the world and return to the way things were. In our lives as well, we receive such gifts. I'm thinking tangentially here of nuclear power. It's a gift we didn't particularly ask for. And some would, if they could, give it back to the gods. But there is no going back. The problem seems to be to find the wisdom to use the gifts that are given to us before they destroy us. And that process, unfortunately, can take more than one lifetime. So near the end of this sermon, I want to turn to the third thread. 2 weeks ago here, I delivered a sermon on the occasion of Treaty Day in Nova Scotia. The theme of that month was promise, and I was exploring the promises we've made to the First Nations of this continent. Specifically, on March 29th of 2014, the Canadian Unitarian Council and the Unitarian Universalist Ministers of Canada committed to a journey of healing and reconciliation between Canadian Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples. This was a formal ceremony, and a formal promise was made. I thought it was about time I got involved in this, so last week I began my effort to live up to that promise, and I was fortunate to meet with Dr. Daniel Paul, Mi'kmaq elder, a recipient of the Order of Canada, and the author of the groundbreaking book, We Were Not the Savages. The one point that he wanted me to take away and to share with the congregation was that the journey to reconciliation must begin with the acceptance of the tragic history of the relationship between our nations. When the first settlers arrived in North America from Europe, it might have seemed to the Aboriginal peoples like a gift from the gods, for the settlers brought many wonderful tools and many useful skills. But the gift would soon be revealed to be a curse. I quote here from We Were Not the Savages. The myth is that the first recorded European Thanksgiving in the Americas was held to celebrate a genuine love fest of respect and admiration between the local First Nations people and the pilgrims. The story is pure romantic hogwash. It was strictly one-sided. The locals, in line with the strictures of their civilization, which mandated that strangers be welcomed with generosity and respect, did welcome the English with open arms, supplying them with food when they were starving and teaching them how to survive in this land. Unfortunately for them, their compassion and generosity was not reciprocated. On the English Puritan side, the goodwill was short-lived. Within a few years, after the numbers had increased substantially, all pretense of friendship disappeared. And they undertook a very successful war of extermination against the local First Nations people. In the movie, the gods must be crazy. The Sand Clan received an unrequested, unmerited gift from the gods. In real life, Gal, the Bushman-turned-actor, received the unexpected gift of fame and fortune that ultimately may have been responsible for his death. And here in Nova Scotia, the Mi'kmaq have received the unrequested gift of European science, religion, culture, weapons, and disease. A gift that has been an unspeakable disaster for them. And there is no way to give back the gift, to throw it off the end of the earth. However, in return, the settlers were offered among many gifts by the Mi'kmaq people, the gift of a spirituality based on a sustainable respect for nature. This could be the beginning of the healing. We have much work to do together. May it be so.